3-1 to Alonso. Williams sets. Here's the pitch. Swinging a fly ball to right field. Pretty well hit. Frelick back at the wall. He jumps. It's gone. He did it. He did it. Pete Alonso with the most memorable home run of his career. Pumps his fist as he rounds second. It's a three-run homer. He's given the
Molitor and Yount threw a baseball. Thomas hits him out. Gentle band.
We had to get a little music in there to get that terrible sound out of our ears from Howie Rose's announcing the WCBS Pete Alonso home run. And what can you say? Well, we're going to find out what can be said. We've got a couple of guests on the show. Great to have them back. Ryan Topp and Paul Noonan. Ryan, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having us back, Larry.
Yeah.
We're happy to be here, even if it's not the greatest of circumstances.
Paul Noonan, yeah, you said, yeah, it's not the greatest of circumstances, is it?
Nope. And it isn't for, you know, most of the other baseball teams' fans either, but
yeah,
alas.
Yeah. Ryan Topp and Paul Noonan host Milwaukee's Tailgate Brewers podcast. And we'll talk with them about the highs of the regular season, the lows of the postseason, and what maybe to expect next season. We can also take a look at what, you know, the teams that are left and what's going on there. I think there's a couple of exciting things to talk about there as well. And I hope you'll join in. What are your thoughts about the Brewers season? Were you at that last game or did you watch it on TV? How did you respond to that terrible ending for us? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. We'd love to hear from you. Have you guys recovered from this? Paul, start with you.
So I'm kind of what I like to call a bad sports fan. I recover from losses very, very quickly. I think my life's actually a little bit better than a lot of people's because of it, because I actually really enjoy the happy stuff that happens, but after 24 hours, I'm good to go. I'm on to football season. So I know people live and die with it. A lot of my relatives do. A lot of my friends do. But I was really mad for 8 hours, and I'm good now.
Ryan, what about you?
Yeah, I'm basically over it at this point. I started looking forward pretty much right away because this is a good young team with lots of stuff to talk about for the future. So I was able to kind of say, okay, that was that. But this one was just such a level of horrifying that we haven't seen in at least 40 years that this has been a tough one to swallow. I think that was the worst sporting event, the most disappointed I've ever been walking out of a sporting event. It was pretty surreal, actually, in a lot of ways. There were Mets fans behind me who were whispering because they didn't want to like upset the herd of all the disappointed solemn Brewer fans proceeding out. They were like keeping their voices down and trying not to be loud and boisterous. I'm sure that wasn't Mets fans all over the place. I'm sure there were Mets fans who were taunting and whatever, but the ones who were behind me on the stairs were doing that. And I'm like, I've never seen anything like that before. I'm used to you leave that park after a Cubs loss and you're used to being taunted by Cubs fans. This was a level of horrifying that I think Mets fans have like some familiarity with. So I think maybe there was a little bit of respect there, but it was pretty wild.
I was watching the game on television. I wasn't at the game, and they showed the Mets stadium. I think it was the Mets stadium. They showed the fans when that home after that home run. And they were boisterous. They were really boisterous.
Oh yeah, well, they had nothing to fear. So that's all the difference.
So just on a quick recap of that game, you know, we had Tobias Myers pitch just five great innings.
Yes.
And then we bring in three relievers who just were lights out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, And this is the way the Brewers have done things all year. And with Tobias Myers in particular, I know I saw some fans wanting to keep him in. He did pitch brilliantly, and he pitched brilliantly for a lot of the season. But he is, like a lot of Brewers starters, significantly worse the third time through the order. And I'll get to some of my criticisms of this game later, which Ryan has fewer than I do, I think. But that's how you should manage in an elimination game, is don't take any chances. Don't futz around with a guy just because you're feeling like he might be good. And Tobias Myers, I think, has something like an 828 OPS against the third time through the order versus like 600 the rest of the time. And so this is what you should do with him. You should pull him after that. You should say, good game. Go hit the showers. We'll pick it up for you. And, you know, until the very last part of the ninth inning, that worked brilliantly. But that is why they did it. We have a ton of metrics on him, and you don't want to let him go too long. That's when he starts to get into trouble.
Yeah, especially with Lindor looming as the leadoff hitter for that third time through the order.
Yep.
And he was the next batter when Myers got pulled. And I know there was griping, but I was 100% with it. Just like I was 100% with it when they pulled Devin Williams in game one as well, because we'd seen that movie before. And so, or I'm sorry, not Devin Williams, Freddie Peralta.
Freddie Peralta.
I'm getting my guys mixed up here. But yeah, when they pulled Freddie Peralta in game one, that was also a controversial thing. And that was the big inning that sunk them happened right after that. And so that was pretty controversial. But this is a thing, a longstanding trend with Tobias Myers, that you don't want to take it too far. And in a game where it was tied at 0-0 at that point, every single thing was going to matter. They couldn't afford to give any ground. They couldn't afford to have Myers throw one bad pitch to Francisco Lindor and have it go over the wall. So they pulled him earlier than I think a lot of people would have liked, but it was very shut down from McGill, who pitched the sixth. It was McGill, and then it was
Mears,
which was a total surprise. Yeah, Mears coming in. You were going, oh, how is this going to work? Because he'd been kind of a home run machine.
Yeah, he had.
And so when Mears comes in for the seventh, you're kind of wondering about that. Then we all had a ton of questions about Freddie Peralta pitching out of in relief in the eighth inning. And that went brilliantly. That was 1-2-3. That was that he absolutely shut them down. And so at that point, you have set up one of the best closers of all time in Devin Williams. I was just listening to another podcast, Effectively Wild. They were talking about the fact that, you know, by a thing that looks at how many runs you allow relative to your era and relative to your park and all of those things, Devin Williams has the second best for relievers who've pitched at least 200 innings in their careers. He is the second best behind only Emmanuel Clase, who's still alive pitching for the Guardians in this postseason. But they're actually ahead of Mariano Rivera. Both of those guys are ahead of Mariano Rivera in terms of runs prevented. Devin Williams is the guy you want in this situation. He is one of the best of all time, and he blew it. And that's going to be a hard thing to just live down for a while here. You set up the situation you wanted, and it went poorly.
Yeah, it did indeed. I was really nervous right away when he had that first walk. I thought, because he doesn't usually walk a lot of people or anybody for that matter. I thought, you know, okay, that's bad. And then he gets an out and then a single, or I forget the order of that.
Yeah, that's right.
Gets an out and then a single, and then Pete Alonso comes up, I think.
Yeah. And that is exactly right, and Pete went the other way and took him deep, and it was a weird bit of circumstance there. And that, so in a vacuum, Williams is a fine choice to pitch to Pete Alonso. You have the platoon advantage. There are just a couple little specific things that came back to bite them. One of which is that Pete Alonso is actually one of the best opposite field hitters that exists, especially for power. He hit that ball out to the opposite field. The Brewer picnic area came back to bite him a little bit there. That was unfortunate. And Williams did not locate that pitch super well, given that Alonso is good at that specific thing. I'm not sure he was thinking about it necessarily, but, you know, is what it is. That's what what he's good at. Righties never take Devin Williams deep. It just doesn't happen very often. And so there's definitely a lot of bad luck baked into that. There's also, of course, Pete Alonso is a very, very good hitter. And sometimes good hitters just have the ability to turn it on in the playoffs. But I would say the couple of at-bats before him were at least a little bit worrying. The walk in particular, Nimmo, singles sometimes happen too. So there weren't like super huge alarm bells. But this was when Devin has trouble, it sometimes does look a little bit like this. And I do wish they would have at least had. So this is an elimination game. And while Williams is your guy in a regular season game, you let him go. You let him work through stuff. I wish they would have at least had guys up in the pen just because of the magnitude of this game. If I'm managing the ninth inning of an elimination playoff game, I am always having people ready to go in the bullpen, regardless of the situation, regardless of how good my closer is, because if he starts to get into trouble, you can pull somebody for the platoon advantage. Or one of the other things about Devin Williams is his best pitch is a changeup. And I don't know how much this played into the course of the game, but that is also Tobias Meyer's best pitch. They both lean on, they're not quite the same pitch. Airbender's a little different, but they've seen a lot of that in this game. And sometimes you just need a guy to come in and throw 100 and change things up and blow people away too. So I would like to see them just have a little bit more preparedness in the ninth, but Williams is, of course, like the best closer of all time. So is what it is. Tip your cap sometimes.
Yeah, go ahead, Ryan. Sorry.
Oh, yeah. I was just going to say that, yeah, it was a tough situation, and they could have definitely had somebody warming, but I don't think you were going to pull Williams in that situation, because this is something we've seen from Williams. We actually have kind of been joking about it on the show for a while now, that he was sort of turning into a little bit of a mini version of 30 Pitches of Terror, which was the nickname for Francisco Rodriguez, who used to be the Brewers closer about a decade ago now. And those were hallmarked by some really long, terrible outings. Devin isn't to that level yet where he struggles and you really watch him sort of melt down, but he has bad outings, and he had some bad outings this year where you could see him walking multiple guys, hitting a batter, and you could sort of see the trouble. But the thing was, he would often wiggle out of those situations too, because he's very, very good at getting the big strikeout when he needs it. And so that was sort of the expectation I had sitting there, was, well, he's going to figure a way to get out of this, especially because he had the platoon advantage on Alonso. I immediately, sitting there in the stadium, said, okay, I wasn't even really worried about Alonso. I was worried they were going to pinch hit, because I think they had Iglesias, who's another right-hander, hitting behind Alonso. And I assumed they were going to pinch hit Jesse Winker for him, and then we would get the lefty. And that was kind of when I was going to get nervous. So when that home run happened, that was the part that kind of took me by surprise.
Yeah.
And it took everybody by surprise. Nobody was expecting that outcome. So, but yeah, I wouldn't have pulled him, but having somebody up and warming, that certainly makes sense.
Yeah, it does indeed. Jim and Ephraim emailed wondering, what do you guys think? Could Murphy, or maybe should he, have left Peralta in for the ninth inning? He looked so strong in the inning before. I would preface that by saying, you know, he's often in this first inning. When he first went in, I shuddered almost, because he has usually a bad first inning if he's going to have a bad inning. But what about Jim's comment?
I'm not sure. So it was such a weird move in the first place. And I'm not sure how to, like, put any kind of scientific rigor to leaving Freddie in for two consecutive innings there. The bottom line is that there was no chance that they were going to do anything other than go to Williams in the ninth. And whether there may be some background statistics that indicate that was right or wrong, because the way that we use closers is not optimal in baseball. It's based on a save rule that is kind of nonsensical. And in the playoffs, you should frankly ignore it. Like, if they thought Freddie could burn through another, even if not the whole inning, like it had kicked off and do okay, that would have been fine. But it was such a weird, like, of all the things I disagreed with in the game, putting in Freddie Peralta randomly in the middle of it was probably on the high list. And the fact that it worked out is is more along the lines of like, well, tip your cap to the Brewers for understanding what they've got there, maybe getting Freddie some confidence and also knowing it's his throw day, he can maybe get through this okay. But I don't think you can make like a really solid argument that he should have stayed in because it was so weird in the first place.
Ryan Topp and Paul Noonan, hosts of the Milwaukee's Tailgate Brewers podcast, our guests. Questions, comments for him, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234. You can email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're taking a look at the Milwaukee Brewers on the show right now with our two guests, Ryan Topp and Paul Noonan, hosts of the Milwaukee's Tailgate Brewers podcast. It's great to have them back. And certainly if you have a question or comment, maybe an experience relating to the Brewers, I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Paul, you said you had some, well, you mentioned a couple of the complaints that you had about the game itself, but talk a bit, were there other things that were on your mind relating to how that game played out?
The rest of the game, I think, went by and large okay. Just in the ninth, I would have had a shorter leash than I think almost anybody else would have. Devin's good, but Devin has had actually trouble in playoff games in the past, and this was his second time pitching on a back to back, which Ryan will bring up in a bit. We can argue about it, but in this scenario, pitching 2 days in a row, he sometimes has issues, and so I think if I had been managing this, I would have had people up. And I would have been really tempted to go to the pen. Now, I still think I maybe would have still lost the game if I was managing it, because I don't think I would have pulled him against Alonzo with the platoon advantage. I wish he would have made it a little more obvious that he was going to struggle by either making it one more batter or not giving up that hit to Nimmo, but walking him. Two walks and I'd have pulled him for sure. A single, I think I let go. But I do wish they would have been a little more aggressive on the ninth, just because in situations where it is do or die, you can't mess around. It's just and I don't like closers in the first place. I don't like the fact that they exist. And I think Devin was showing some signs of struggling.
Yeah. Ryan?
Yeah. So the thing about the back-to-backs is a little bit interesting, because that immediately went around Brewer's Twitter essentially right away that he has struggled in back-to-backs. But the problem is that it was such a small sample size. We were talking about five games going into that night this year where he had pitched on back-to-back nights, and three of those five games he had been 1-2-3 in those innings. So he got into trouble in one of them, but like I was talking about, he wiggled off the hook in one of those games on August 31st. He wiggled off the hook. It was the one game against the Cardinals on August 21st where it all blew up in his face. He had three walks. He had a hit by pitch. He gave up a hit. He ended up giving up two earned runs and ended up kicking away the game there against the Cardinals in a pretty big game in the season at that point, though it ended up not really mattering. The Brewers ran away with the division. So how much you want to put onto that one game, those two games on the 21st and 31st, I have a hard time putting too much stake in that. I agree with Paul. The idea of having somebody up isn't harmful, but it was a little bit weird in that they had Joe Ross, and Joe Ross ended up replacing Devin Williams in that game, another right-hander. And I think the thing to have done there, and if you want to criticize, was he didn't have a lefty up, and he could have had Jared Koenig, who's been very good. He could have had Jared Koenig up as a, if it got to the situation where we were talking about, where they got to the fifth batter, there were two outs, and you had Jesse Winker pinch hit for it. I still don't think Murphy would have pulled Williams. I don't think he would have. I don't think most managers would have. But that would be where you'd have a little bit more wiggle room to, like, say, well, okay, you can get the platoon advantage here and potentially end the game. And, yes, Devin is going to be unhappy. Yes, it's going to be unorthodox. But I think that could have been more of a move. But Murphy didn't even, as far as I remember, I don't remember seeing Koenig ever warming.
He did not.
Yeah.
And I will say, so you're right. It was a small sample size. There were only five back-to-backs all year, and he only struggled debatably in two of them. And the only thing I would say with that is he basically, outside of when he first came back off of the injured list, when he did struggle one other time against Atlanta on August 7th, he really only struggled on back-to-backs. And that's why I would have been at least a little cautious there, is it was one of the only situations that happened all year where he really got himself into any kind of serious trouble. This ended up not mattering, but not pulling him and allowing him to give up the fourth run, I think, was also not the greatest managing. Because we didn't know that at the time. Being down by one is a lot better than being down by two. It could even have impacted how they played the rest of the game. Having to score two runs is a lot more difficult than having to score one run. So I also think that he managed that portion very poorly. He let him plunk Winker when he came up. I definitely would have yanked Devin after he got down, for sure.
Well, Winker got plunked twice in the game. And I was interesting. I saw a little piece from one of the New York papers that said that Adames did go out to the parking lot. Apparently, the game before, they had some words, and there were words back and forth, and so Winker was getting booed very loudly every time he got up to the plate. But apparently, they had decided they were going to meet in the parking lot after that third game, and Adames did show up, but Winker didn't. And I'm sure Adames said he showed up, but there was no sign of Jesse Winker anywhere. And I'm sure if Winker had wanted to go, the Mets probably would have held him back and not let him go out there to suddenly, you know, get his eye blackened or whatever.
Winker's whole history with the Brewers is obviously it's a wild ride from them bringing him in to start last year and hoping that they were going to get a bounce back from what he had been the year before, and then having an absolutely miserable year, basically disappearing from the roster for the last almost half of the season, and then showing back up on the playoff roster to come in and pinch hit in two late game situations where he got booed, which is the first time I'd ever seen, like, preemptively booing your own player. I'd never seen that before. And I think people could argue it was more booing Craig Counsell for using him there. There's no love lost there, to say the least. There was actually an incident. I happened to be sitting very close to the field on Friday night because the Brewers were playing the Mets the last series of the year. Their last series of the year, they had to still go to Atlanta at that point. And Jesse Winker got plunked on Friday night. And when he leaned down to take off his shin guard, and he took it right on the keister. And when he turned around, when he was leaning down to take off his guard, he looked at the Brewers dugout, had words for them, and basically kind of said, yeah, I know what you just did to me. I know that was on purpose. And so when he had the chance to stick it to them, when he was running around the bases on Tuesday night, when he hit the bases clearing triple to, you know, help the Mets the lead and ultimately that they wouldn't relinquish in game one, he was yapping very loudly at what looked like a very surprised Willie Adames, right? Willie didn't seem to recognize what exactly was going on there. He didn't feel that was warranted, but yeah, it was some great drama, some great TV. It just stinks when you're on the losing end of it, right?
Yeah.
Richard in Madison's got something for us. Richard, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yes. I am a devoted baseball fan. I've been so for many years. I love the Brewers. I love the game. But there's one thing about the game of baseball that really bothers me. In every other major sport, football, basketball, hockey, when a team wins a big game, they don't just celebrate, but they go and they shake hands with a losing team. They show sportsmanship. It's only in baseball that a team dances around on the field and leaves the unfortunate losers to sit there morose, staring at it all. Nobody comes over to shake hands with them. Can that ever be changed?
You think that's ever going to be changed?
Nah, I really don't. I think it's culturally built into all of those sports. I mean, hockey, it's very much of a, yeah, we beat each other to death and then shake hands afterwards. And I kind of get that one more than anything else. Baseball, I think it's just more, it's too many games. And for a lot of guys, it really is like more their job than it is anything else. And they're there to play the game. And afterwards, you know, especially during a regular season game, you're just going to sleep. You're going home. You're not interested in, you're shaking hands with those guys like every night. If you do that, that's a lot of handshaking. I don't think that ever changes. And I don't think, honestly, this is just people will have different opinions on this. I do not care what the players do with each other after the game at all. Shaking hands or not.
Richard, thank you for calling. You can join in too. Number to call 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. Take a look at the season as well. I mean, if I'm remembering correctly, the Brewers were only out of first place 17 games.
It wasn't many.
The whole year. And Jeff is wondering, did not having meaningful games down the stretch hurt the Brewers?
That's always a tough one to try to assess. I think they were playing fairly well down the stretch. They had a brief period, sort of early to mid-September, where they seemed to have a little bit of a lull, and they reeled off some losses kind of right around the time they were getting close to clinching. But then they, down the stretch, they took two of three from the Mets in the last series. In the second to last series, they took two of three from the Pirates. They were playing relatively well at the very end there. They had that wild comeback on the second to last Sunday of the year against Arizona, where they were down 8 runs and then ended up winning 10-9. And so I don't think that's what this is. I don't think that's the thing here. It does feel like it's sometimes that's what happens, but there have been a lot of studies on this trying to figure out, is it better to come into the postseason rested? Is it better to come in basically hot, like you were playing a bunch of games that you had to win? And there doesn't seem to be much of a rhyme or reason to it, because it's baseball and there's just too many different things that can happen in any one game that there's a certain amount of randomness to baseball that there isn't in some other sports.
Yeah, if you want to look at what the Brewers might have as sort of a flawed approach to the playoffs, it's far more likely that they're so based on depth as a team, that the Brewers' big strengths are bullpen depth and defense. And they have some stars, like Jackson Chourio is turning into a star. Willy Adames is very good. William Contreras is very good. But in a short series, a 3-game series, even a 5-gamer, but a 3-game for sure, the depth of your bullpen doesn't matter as much. And having like 5 top tier hitters matters a lot more, just because, you know, you will lean on those guys more than you might during the regular season. You're not giving them random days off in the playoffs. If this is all hands on deck. And when you construct your team through depth, you are at least a slight disadvantage via that strategy in that short series that comes up and bites you every year. So I don't think it's anything by having to be steeled in the regular season by playing more important games. A lot of it's luck, and a lot of it is just eventually you run into big money teams like the Phillies and the Dodgers and the Mets, and they often have just better offenses, especially than us. And while they sometimes don't have as good a bullpen, especially on the backside, you don't have to go into the bullpens that deeply in the playoffs as much.
Yeah, and I'm just thinking about that series. I was glad that the Brewers didn't have to play Arizona.
Yep,
and
we all were.
The Mets, the Brewers beat the Mets 5 out of 6 games in the regular season, 5 out of 6 times. So that was really hopeful, made me hopeful. But then you look at the vets, the veterans in that 3-game series did not hit hardly at all. Hoskins didn't get a hit, Reese Hoskins, I don't think. And Willy Adames might have had 1 hit. And Contreras had maybe 1 or 2 hits. So, I mean, those three resulted in, I think, three hits total in those three games. And that was really a killer. It was the younger guys that actually showed up better.
Well, Jackson Churio was absolutely amazing. That game two performance from him, where he hits the leadoff homer to start the game and then hits the game tying home run. Well, both were game tying home runs. Hits the game tying home run then in the, was it the eighth? Were just moments that are going to live with me forever. And that second game felt like such an exorcism of so many demons that the Brewers have dealt with in the postseason for so long. And Garrett Mitchell coming in then and hitting another really improbable home run that we weren't expecting. And then, you know, speaking of improbable home runs, you had Jake Bowers, who's been a pretty mediocre guy that we've sort of been joking on the podcast all year that Jake Bowers is exactly the kind of guy who's going to hit a big home run in the postseason out of nowhere, because that's just what guys like Jake Bowers do, and it's baseball. But the one that followed that, certainly, I'll let Paul talk about this, Sal Frelick's home run that gave them that two-run lead, the back-to-back home runs, and he smoked that baseball. And I think, I think that was the hardest hit ball he had all season.
It was 109 mile an hour exit velocity. Just for context, during the regular season, Statcast Baseball Savant tracks everybody's exit velocity, how hard they hit balls on a regular basis, and Sal Frelick was last. He was the weakest hitter in baseball. Now he would still get hits. He'd hit, you know, line drive singles, and he's fast and stuff like that. But nobody hit the ball less hard than him. And so he gets up in the playoffs. And yeah, he absolutely tanked that home run. It was 109-mile exit velocity, about 26 miles an hour harder than he hits balls usually. That was the most surprising thing that happened all playoffs and that will happen all playoffs. So, I mean, the guys who came through for them, you're right, are not their stars at all. If you want to have one criticism that you might be able to level against the team as well, and early in the season, and we've kind of forgot about this narrative. Early in the season, though, both William Contreras and Willie Adames basically demanded that they stop having as many days off. And it's not like they got no days off, but I think especially in the case of William Contreras, you could argue he maybe should have had more days off. He actually had a bad knee in the playoffs, as Pat Murphy likes to say. He had a scratchy knee, and he didn't catch the last game because of it. And I think wearing down two of your best three hitters was maybe not the best idea for playoff success.
Yeah, Contreras didn't look at all comfortable at the plate batting in that last game even. You know, you wonder if he should have even been in there to have an at-bat. He just, they didn't look comfortable.
He did not.
And it certainly showed up in that game. Well, as we think about the Brewers, one of the things I wanted to go back to was Tobias Myers and pitching just in general. Now, Tobias Myers had a terrible time in AAA. He had like a 7 ERA or something like that with two or three other teams before he gets to the Brewers, and suddenly he's a great pitcher, or a very good pitcher, and you look at the pitching in general, the Brewers have been known to get people in who weren't doing well, and suddenly they do well when they're playing with the Brewers. So what's going on?
So this is absolutely an organizational thing from top to bottom. A lot of people give credit to Chris Hook, and I'm sure he deserves a lot of it. He's the Brewers pitching coach, but this is an organizational thing from top to bottom. They were one of the first teams, and this goes back to the beginning of the David Stearns era, possibly even before. They built a pitching lab down in Arizona and started to really take pitching, a very scientific approach to pitching. And so they're ahead of a lot of organizations in terms of finding things about pitchers that they are going to accentuate. They'll take the good things that pitchers do and they will accentuate them. They'll ask them to do more of them. They will get rid of the things that don't work. They will tweak things to make things go from, like a pitch, to make it go from good to bad. They're so good at this that they can sort of create pitching depth out of thin air. And you look across the roster this year, Tobias Myers would just be one example of this. Colin Ray was an example of this for them last year. and he was, you know, coming into this year a little bit more established, but he was the same phenomenon coming out of it the year before. You can look around in the bullpen, and there's just guy after guy after guy. Koenig would definitely fit that bill.
Definitely.
Yeah, these are all guys that the Brewers have accentuated. We talked about this the last time we were on the podcast earlier this summer, that the Brewers are just among the best teams in baseball at figuring out how to make their players, specifically pitchers, but I think they're getting better on the hitting side at this too, at just making their guys better. And this is what they have to do to be able to compete in a game where, like you talked about, you have very unequal salaries between the top big market clubs and the small market clubs. And so this is the thing the Brewers do so well, and it allows them to compete with the big boys. And I think you can't really overestimate the importance of that, that they're brilliant at this. It's like their core competency. It's what they do best.
Yeah.
So you've got a guy like Chirio. I was thinking about Ryan Braun, Christian Yelich, guys that were really good and then got injured. I just pray or hope at least that Chirio is not going to fall into that hole.
So I don't think, at least immediately, I wouldn't give too much worry to that at all. So the main thing with Jackson Chirio is, first of all, he is at worst the second best prospect the franchise has ever had. And that the only person in contention for that is Yount, obviously is probably the franchise's greatest player. Ryan Braun did not make his major league debut until he was 23 years old. Jackson Chirio turned 20 during this season. So already you are working with 3 years of Jackson Chirio before you even get into the range where Ryan Braun started playing Major League Baseball, but the highest level of Major League Baseball. And injuries really don't anybody can get hurt, but injuries are really an old man's problem in baseball, and baseball old is not real person old. It's like starts to hit you when you're like 28. But yes. So Chirio, they really have for his true prime, like his absolute youth. They have him signed till I think he essentially is like 29 or 30, right, Ryan? Mm-hmm. So
yeah, they have 8 years and then 2 years of team options that they can add to that, which takes him through his age 29 season.
Yeah. So obviously freak injuries can happen. Christian Yelich broke his own kneecap. Stuff like that is unpredictable. But in terms of soft tissue injuries and things like that, Chirio just shouldn't experience them for many, many, many years. And we should have the absolute best part of his career. And they did a great job signing him, taking a risk at signing him to a giant long contract before he actually showed this level of promise in baseball. We all hoped he would have this, but they have him locked up to a very team-friendly contract for a decade. And so this is the best possible scenario you could have with a guy like Chirio.
So let's look at the rest of the players. You know, I remember watching the last game of the regular season, and when Willie Adames, they took him out early in that game, and they got a big hug from Pat Murphy, and it was like that's a goodbye hug, maybe, probably.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think Willie Adames, if they were going to re-sign him, that would have happened before this year even started, and probably even earlier than that. I don't think they ever got all that close to it. And this is going to be a really tough one to swallow, because Willie Adames is a fantastic teammate. According to everybody who has spoken about this, nobody comes in less than absolutely raving about what a great teammate he is. And until this year, he had been a great defender too, which made sort of those two things were sort of his hallmarks. And you could then take some offensive ups and downs. And he had some offensive ups and downs. His game is based around power. And sometimes when he's hitting for power, it's great. But when he's not hitting for power, it doesn't work as well overall. But this year, his defense started to fall off in some really noticeable ways. It starts showing up in both visually, you see him making mistakes he didn't used to make, and also in the advanced metrics. And I think ultimately the Brewers are probably getting out at the right time here with Willy Adames, mm-hmm. because he's certainly going to sign a big contract with somebody, and he absolutely deserves it. I hope he gets every penny he possibly can from, I don't know, the Dodgers or whoever. The Dodgers need a shortstop, so go ahead and get every penny you possibly can from one of those teams. But I think in a few years, people are going to be looking at it going, oh, the Brewers probably got out at the right time with Willy Adames, because the defense has already started to show some pretty significant cracks. And he is now moving out of that prime. He's moving into his 30s. I don't think he's quite there yet. I think he's 28, 29 right now. But he'll be moving into his 30s in the life of this contract. And I think you'll expect to see some decline there. So this is going to be a tough one to swallow from a fan perspective. But from a team management standpoint, they already have Joey Ortiz to take his spot, right? So Joey Ortiz is a very, very good defensive shortstop who's been playing third base this year because Willie was also a great defensive shortstop coming into the year. So they kind of slid him over and said, okay, that's where you're going to play. But Joey Ortiz is ready to be an everyday shortstop at the big league level. So they have the ready-made replacement there.
Yeah. Well, then who plays third?
Well, that is so one of the problems with, so Ryan is right that this is a good time to get out of having to pay Willie. Willie is great, but he crashed on defense really hard. That's often a presage to your offense taking a backseat too. And a lot of guys, when they can't play shortstop anymore, can move and still be effective, but his bat doesn't carry other positions. But just because you're getting out from underneath what could become a bad contract doesn't mean you still don't have a problem. And the Brewers do have a problem because they only have like 3.5 good hitters on the team, and Willy Adames is one of them. It is a problem coming into next season, and it's a worse problem without Willie's bat. They need to actually go out and get a few bats to fix this. Right now, they're gonna have a really, really poor offense. If they just go into the year with William Contreras and Jackson Churio and half of Garrett Mitchell as their best hitters. And Garrett Mitchell's only good against one side of the pitchers, not the other side. That's why. And so I think that is an open spot right now. I think the Brewers' third baseman for next year is probably not on the team. And so hopefully they go shopping, and hopefully they actually bring in a bat or two to fix one of their major problems from this year.
Ryan Topp and Paul Noonan, the hosts of the Milwaukee's Tailgate Brewers podcast. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at the Milwaukee Brewers season, and we also need to talk a bit about the playoffs that are still going on with our two guests today, Ryan Topp and Paul Noonan, hosts of the Milwaukee's Tailgate Brewers podcast. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. We should mention, before we're out of time here, the series, you know, it's still going on. I hope the Mets lose, but I don't like Philadelphia either. as a fan, I think the most exciting to me, and the games that I have really enjoyed watching are is San Diego and the Los Angeles Dodgers. That series, because they really seem to hate each other.
Yeah, there seems to be bad blood between both matchups in the NLDS this year, because Philly and the Mets, obviously there's a long, long history of antagonism between those franchises, and these are both within the division matchups that they have going on. So yeah, there seems to be no love lost. There was some embarrassment at Dodger Stadium last night with people throwing baseballs onto the field and maybe some other stuff. That's not a good look for the sport, but it also, you know, that's one of those things where it's like, it's a bad look for the sport, but it's also kind of that ratchets up the interest, mm-hmm. and the people are like, oh, there might be like a fight. I need to tune in and see this game. So I think that might draw some eyeballs that wouldn't otherwise pop in on that. But yeah, I sort of go back and forth. The Brewers have this history of when they have been knocked out of the postseason, they have always been knocked out by a team that goes to the World Series.
Yep, every time.
And oftentimes by the World Series winner has been the team that has ended up knocking them out. And it's really something to watch this happen year after year after year. And one thing that occurred to me was, if that string is ever going to be broken, this year would be a good one, because if the Phillies knock the Mets out, Pete Alonso's home run in that game gets relegated to sort of a side channel of history. If the Mets go on and win this World Series, we will never, ever, ever see the end of that home run. We will see constantly, forever, and always. And I just would like to get that home run out of my life as soon as possible. So if whatever has to happen, baseball gods, for you to do that, just go ahead and take care of that for us, because I don't need that in my life.
I think we should quickly mention last night, too, in the ridiculous Phillies-Mets game that the Phillies won 7-6, that was an insane game. The Brewer pitcher Trevor McGill's brother Tyler actually took the loss in that game. So our curse is spreading to other places as well.
Well, I thought the San Diego LA game last night was really interesting, when Machado throws a ball into the LA dugout, which very much angered LA, and was it Profar, I think, who faked catching a home run ball. And that irritated people.
There's been a lot of taunting, yes. And Profar, it was great taunting. We should give credit where credit is due. But it's not good for tamping down the bad blood that exists there. So it's nice to have teams that hate each other playing each other, honestly. Like, it gives a little more oomph to it. If it's two random teams that barely ever see each other, it's not as fun. This is better, for sure.
And I really like the San Diego fan base. I've got a friend who was a huge San Diego, from San Diego, a huge Padres fan. So I'm kind of rooting for them a little bit anyway, just because of him. But that fan base, they've got some really cool things that they do as fans, and they are loud and they never seem to shut up.
Yeah. Yeah, I have a coworker, close friend of mine at work, who's a big Padres fan, and so we talk a lot about that. And yeah, the Padres thing is quite interesting, and they've managed to keep themselves relevant here a little bit longer than I thought maybe they could. So they're going to come crashing down pretty hard in a few years, but for right now they're sort of at the pinnacle. So we'll see if they can manage to get in a World Series.
Yeah, I kind of hope they do. I'm not, it's always fun to see that kind of multi-billion-dollar payroll go down that the Dodgers have. So this is me as the fan talking here again. I'd rather they didn't. Well, what do you think the Brewers, in the last minute, what do you think the Brewers are going to be like in the coming season?
Well, they had the best rookie class in franchise history this year. By Fangraphs WAR, they had the best rookie class and 15th in the existence of their franchise. So going back to 1969. So I think they're going to continue to build mostly from within. I hope Paul is right that they add some players from the outside, but I don't know how necessarily proven those players are going to be. I think it's going to be a lot more of the same, where they bring in guys and do this development thing with them and try to develop them up, as opposed to bringing in proven commodities. But I think they have a good base to go forward, right, with having this fantastic rookie class led by Churio.
Yeah,
I think I would like them to go get Bregman, but they definitely won't. So Ryan is correct that it will mostly be, they'll still be good. Like they have their method of doing things. Their bullpen will still be good. While they will lose Adames, they'll still be a dominant defensive team. And a full season of Churio with an additional year of experience will actually probably mitigate a lot of the offense that they lose. But they'll still be a good team. Their division will probably be marginally better. I think the Cubs will probably get stuff figured out a little bit. And they won't be as pathetic as they were this year across the division. But I think they'll look a lot like they did this year. They'll be very pitching heavy. They'll be very defense heavy. And the offense, just got to see who comes around and if they actually bother to add a bat or two.
Paul, Ryan, thank you both so much. Ryan Topp and Paul Noonan, hosts of Milwaukee's Tailgate Brewers podcast, our guests today. Thanks to them. And thank you for listening. And stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR. I'm Larry Mueller.